Well, tensions between India and Pakistan escalating rapidly, with the Home Ministry ordering civil defense mock drills for the 7th of May. Think about it, this could be the first time that this is happening since the 1971 war. And it clearly comes at a time when tensions between India and Pakistan really extreme. We'll be joined in a little while by the former Foreign Secretary, Harsh Shringla. But for now, we'll be joined by General Yash Moore. Daniel Block, a senior editor, Foreign Affairs, and a contributing editor at the Washington Monthly. John Rossomondo is a national security analyst in the U.S. Thank you all very much for being with us. General Moore, I think it is particularly striking that, you've got these civil defense drills which will take place on the 7th. I mean, it's fairly unheard of over here in India. Do you believe that this is essentially the lull before a storm?
Vishnu, thank you for inviting me to your program. Yeah, I think all the actions that are being taken by the government, this does point towards preparedness, and it's good that we exercise our administration, our civic agencies, and our people become aware, because this time India appears much more serious. We are not looking for one-off event. We are looking for whole of a nation approach economically, diplomatically, and we are just waiting for kinetic measures where the military might will come and bear on the Pakistan forces. So, yeah, but it's good to prepare. There's no harm. I see this as absolutely a preventive and a proactive activity.
John Rossomondo, from where you're at, do you believe that it's just a matter of time before, there are military strikes, India responding to what Pakistan did with the Pahalgam terror attacks?
Well, I think that, I don't want to jump to any conclusions, but I think the fact that India is calling for civil defense drills suggests that the people at the top know that something's coming, that there's some sort of intelligence or something along those lines. But I think that, we've been seeing the efforts by both sides to probe each other. So I think that it would not take much for all-out war to start. I mean, the Pakistanis are saying that they'll do everything up through the use of nuclear weapons. So, this is definitely a scary time.
Daniel Block, how do you see the situation in the subcontinent?
Well, I agree with what the previous guest said. It's a scary time. The main thing that alarms me in some way is I don't see any real checks here along the path to conflict. There's strong incentives for both sides to continue to escalate. Nationalist officials in both governments that have a lot to gain from looking tough, from continuing to engage in provocative measures, from upping the tension in various ways. And on the outside, I don't see any state stepping in to try and mediate or negotiate in a way that's happened in the past. The United States is not playing as active a role as it has previously in trying to lower tensions and trying to come to some sort of compromise. But Marco Rubio, the Secretary of State, I believe has attempted to do some mediating, but Trump has shown relatively little interest in the same way that he did, or his administration at least did, in 2019.
There's also been a reaction just in the last 5 minutes. I'm just going to read that out. It's come from the United Nations Secretary General on tensions between India and Pakistan, which are at their highest in years, where Mr. Guterres has said, "It pains me to see relations reaching a boiling point. I once again strongly condemn that attack, the Pahalgam attack, and extend my condolences to the families of the victims. Targeting civilians is unacceptable. Those responsible must be brought to justice through credible, lawful means. It's also essential, especially at this critical juncture, critical hour, to avoid a military confrontation that could easily spin out of control." General Yash Moore, two nuclear neighbors over here, but India has been pushed very much to the brink on this case. There is an element of nuclear blackmail as well, which India or many over here see may be taking place. We've seen it from Pakistan in the past. Do you believe that whatever we do, we need to factor in nuclear blackmail from Pakistan, or do you believe the threat is viable?
See, Vishnu, this nuclear saber rattling is something we have always discounted. I think if we start talking of both nuclear power states, then you are trying to somewhere mellow down your military responses. I think there is sufficient space, and this issue has been wargamed enough times. Pakistan doesn't have the gumption nor the guts to go nuclear, and we have seen this in Kargil. And so I don't think there's any chance. because if you have to hit military targets, legitimate military targets, the kind of situation that Pakistan is in economically, financially, diplomatically, cornered from all sides, I don't see this at all. Whatever little study I've done on nuclear deterrence, India's NFU is very much in place. Our draft nuclear doctrine always spoke of NFU, but we speak of massive nuclear retaliation. So I think military planners should totally discount any kind of nuclear blackmail, nuclear saber rattling, which normally the Pakistanis would be trying to do at this stage. But no, I think there is sufficient space below the nuclear threshold to punish the perpetrators of this terrible incident that has taken place in Pahalgam on 22nd.
You know, John, from an Indian standpoint, and as somebody who's tracked the Indo-US strategic relationship for almost 30 years, I mean, 30 years ago, it wasn't there. It started getting better and then progressively got much, much better. New Delhi is counting on Washington now as a strategic ally, perhaps more than ever before. How, in a sense, does Washington need to come onto the table, whether it's with intelligence sharing or with anything else that New Delhi needs? Because this, from New Delhi's standpoint, is where it's at.
Well, I think that the president needs to step up here. I mean, he's spending a lot of political capital between Russia and Ukraine. He needs to focus here in South Asia, where you could actually have a nuclear exchange. I mean, the fact that you have people like Kash Patel, Indian American, people like DNI, Tulsi Gabbard, both having like Indian ties, I think they should be pushing the president to take a more personal role in defusing this conflict, because things can get out of hand really fast, and the Pakistanis, if they feel cornered, they might do something rash.
Daniel, there's the entire aspect of financially where this leaves Pakistan. Now, Moody's issued a warning today, and they stated that escalation could severely damage Pakistan's economy, and it could derail progress, threaten external funding, and strain foreign exchange reserves. India is a much larger economy. We wouldn't face that sort of an impact at all. It just increasingly seems that Pakistan is besieged. Economically, they're in trouble. They've got trouble on the Balochistan front. They've been responsible for this Pahalgam terror attack as well. And economically, if something escalates, it could be a survival issue for Pakistan as a country. I mean, that's how economists are reading it. I mean, that's what Moody's seems to be suggesting. Is that something that perhaps Islamabad needs to be reminded about?
I think the Pakistanis are probably aware of the fact that they're in an economically difficult situation. Unfortunately, that runs both ways in terms of the effect it has on escalation. So on the one hand, it should push Pakistan away from escalation because of the possible negative economic consequences, which you just laid out. On the other hand, one thing we've seen around the world is that countries that are under economic stress, under economic pressure, there are times in which they will turn to foreign policy, to saber-rattling, sometimes to outright conflict as a way to distract their population from economic difficulties, with nationalism acting as a kind of salve, a kind of balm for the various domestic problems that they face. So while it's certainly not in Pakistan's interests to have a war with India, and for that matter, it's not really in India's interests either to have a war with Pakistan. I mean, it's in nobody's interest to have a war between two nuclear armed powers. That won't necessarily have a restraining effect on the Pakistani government. I mean, it could, in some circumstances, have an escalating effect.
Yeah. General Moore, in as much as we talk about the situation on the line of control, and every morning there are these press notes from the Defense Ministry saying that, there's been yet another instance of small arms fire. And as we talk about, going up the escalation matrix, it strikes me sometimes that people may not necessarily know what that means. That when you get into a war or you get into a military conflict, you can't right-size it. We did right-size it to a certain extent during Balakot. We did right-size it to a certain extent during the surgical strikes. But there is no guarantee that that's going to happen every time, right?
Yeah, I agree with you. But whatever we are hearing in last 10 days, it's mostly small arms exchange of fire. at places where, you know, some places where we dominate, other places, you know how the line of control moves. So thankfully, till now, no heavy caliber weapons have opened up, no artillery has opened up, tanks have not moved close and taking pot shots on the bunkers. So as of now, this kind of situation we have seen worse than this during the Kargil conflict. So we'll wait and watch. But I'm sure, for the Pakistan military, this is an hour where, there's a lot of stress on the Pakistan military within Pakistan because of what is happening in Balochistan, what is happening in KPK, and Asim Munir, his own image as the army chief, the entire army establishment, deep state. You are aware, 9th May, how people walked into Corps Commander's house and military garrisons were all swarmed by people of Pakistan. With Imran Khan in jail, the Pakistan military is facing a backlash domestically. So that must be factored in as we read the situation going ahead. But as of now, line of control remains active in various sectors, and it's limited to small arms fire.
John Rossomondo, at this stage, is there any doubt that Pakistan is an epicenter of global terrorism? The U.S. hunted down Osama bin Laden. You knew about Pakistan's links within Afghanistan earlier on with the Al-Qaeda. The ISI, almost synonymous. As a journalist on the ground, I've seen it. I've interviewed people who fought in Kashmir who were then jailed in Afghanistan. And it just seems that so much more needs to have been done or said to said to Pakistan that, look, enough is enough. Not just what India has been saying for decades.
Well, I have to say one thing. Pakistan is the largest undesignated sponsor of terrorism. I mean, everything from the Mumbai attacks to the attack in Pahalgam, which allegedly was perpetrated in part by a former Pakistani special forces who was loaned by the ISI to the Lashkar-e-Taiba TRF, to Al-Qaeda, as you were saying. I mean, I have lots of friends who were in the former Afghan military, and they said they kept on finding ISI badges among the dead Taliban. So I think that President Trump should consider adding Pakistan to the State Department's list of designated terrorists, so that would bring about financial sanctions that the Pakistanis can't afford. So I think that more definitely needs to be done.
John, just remind our viewers, how many years were you in Afghanistan? As a soldier?
I've never been in a soldier, but I work closely politically with exiled Afghan generals, the former vice president of Afghanistan, Amrullah Saleh, and other top people following the fall of Kabul. So I've talked to these special forces and also U.S. special forces guys who fought alongside them, and they all say that they found ISI identity cards among some of the Taliban dead.
No, so John, let me just therefore narrate a story of my own, and we've reported it. We reported it decades back, more than a decade back, in 2002. So it's been a while. We were covering the Afghanistan war. We were among the first journalists to get in. The Northern Alliance, which was in power, which was trying to push into Kabul at that stage, had a jail near the Panjshir Valley, where they invited us to go and film, and we invited people who said that they'd fought in Kashmir. And these were Pakistani nationals. They were all on tape. They weren't being forced to speak. They just said what they had to. They said they managed to get out after X number of weeks or X number of days. It's that blunt. It's that clear. You've got terrorists who come on record and say, yeah, I went and I attacked people in Kashmir. And so, therefore, Daniel Block, so many decades later, we still have Pakistan as an epicenter of terrorism. And when people over here feel that not enough has been done, do you believe that, you know, there's merit in that argument?
Well, let's put it this way. The United States had to do a deal with the devil during the Afghanistan war because our supply lines were controlled by the Pakistanis. Fuel, water, weapons, all came through on Pakistan-controlled trucks. So now that that's over, the United States should take the gloves off on Pakistan. You already have some people who are close to President Trump, like Ambassador Rick Grenell, who want sanctions against Pakistan over the jailing of Imran Khan. I mean, we can debate over Mr. Khan's terrorism connections there, too. But I think there's a lot of more free hand for the U.S. to do things.
Daniel, last word to you. Any thoughts, you know, linked to what I was asked? Has enough been done by countries like the United States to shut down Pakistani terror? We face, for example, the threat of American-built F-16s all these decades later. They used them in 2019. If there is an air war, which is a possibility, those armed with AMRAAM missiles, which have apparently been equipped to fight terrorists, right? Those will be used against the Indian Air Force. It's ludicrous.
So I think that the challenge that the United States faced in the past, as John was saying, is that the U.S. military, to some extent, needed elements of the Pakistani government as it conducted the global war on terror. The problem, of course, is the Pakistani government has displayed time and time again that it's quite weak. It does not act in a unified fashion. You have some elements of the Pakistani government that are interested in crushing terrorists. You have other elements that are obviously funding terrorist organizations and that support it. Now, as John was saying, now you have a situation where the United States does not need Pakistan in the same way. And in theory, that would open more latitude for the United States to take a different approach to Pakistan from what it did before, to not necessarily sell it as many weapons. The issue, of course, now is that the United States is, it appears under the Trump administration, just simply less interested in that part of the world.
No, I would tend to, agree with you, and that's a cause of serious concern. Look, gentlemen, I'm out of time over here. Thanks very much for being with us. I spoke to India's G20 Sherpa and our former Foreign Secretary Harsh Shringla a short while back. Here's what he told me. Well, these are clearly tense times in the subcontinent. Joining us now to discuss some of the latest developments, Harsh Shringla, India's G20 Sherpa, and also the former Foreign Secretary of India. Thanks sir, very much for being with us. So I'd like you to reflect on something that just come in the last 15, 20 odd minutes, with the Home Ministry asking several states to conduct mock drills for effective civil defense, including operationalization of air raid warning sirens, training of civilian students, civil defense measures. In all your years of experience, do you believe that based on this, that we may now be in a lull before the storm sort of situation with potential military strikes possibly coming up?
Well, Vishnu, it's been 2 weeks since the Pahalgam attack took place, and in this period of time, there's been several I would say strands of thought on when and how the retaliation should take place. I think there's no doubt that there will be retaliation, but increasingly the sense is the retaliation will be at our own time and our own place of choosing. I think preparedness is an important part of anything that is underway now. In other words, any actions you take would invite some level of response from Pakistan. You may need to be prepared, and I think it's important for certain border areas to prepare in terms of blackouts, in terms of having emergency measures in place. But I don't know whether it really indicates that, something is due to happen. I mean, that is an operational decision, very closely held. It could be, soon after we speak, it could take some time. But I think that's the important thing. I don't think we need to give our, adversaries the sort of advantage of a knee-jerk reaction. You know, something happens and you react straight away. You need to think it over. You need to consider it. You need to hit him where it I think affects him the most, and most important I think is a suitable response to that terrorist attack, not only because it's punitive but also because it's a deterrent for future terrorist attacks, and that deterrent has to be strong enough to ensure that Pakistan does not resort to terrorism again. And so I think that is what our policymakers would have kept in mind, that the nature of our response should be such that it should be absolutely clear that that such acts of terrorism does not pay, and of course that we will do what we have to do when it best suits us.
In other words, this is not going to be action for the sake of optics. It's going to be something based on sending a strong message to Pakistan and perhaps inflicting serious damage where it counts, right?
Yes, I think so. I think it is a message. Of course, it's a message that you don't indulge in terrorism, and if you do, it is going to be at considerable cost to you. That's one. And secondly, of course, is the fact that you want to make it clear that there is any scope of any such actions in the future will continue to invite very strong retribution. So it's a question of what how much your response should be, whether it's and how much is sufficient. What is a suitable response? And that is, again, something that we have to consider very carefully. I think we should not think on conventional lines. There are many, many areas that could be a response that could be painful for Pakistan. We've already seen the holding the Indus Water Treaties in abeyance does have a certain amount of impact. Some of our other steps, including stopping all forms of exchanges, communications, I think would have a salutary impact. Including having their defense attaches and others return back home would stop an important source of information. Sending Pak nationals back home, I think, is an important step. But we need to calibrate these decisions and to see what more we can do that can hurt them both in diplomatic and military terms.
I think there's something else that Pakistan needs to be wary of, which is that according to the ratings agency Moody's in a report today, they've said that any escalation by Pakistan would severely damage their economy. It would derail progress, threaten external funding, and strain foreign exchange reserves. India wouldn't really feel much of an impact, other than if we increased our defense budget, something which may happen either way. When one considers escalation, right, possibly a war, possibly something short of a war, Pakistan's economy is going to be hit at a time when it's particularly fragile.
Yes, it's already very vulnerable. I mean, I think Pakistan is clearly, has been and continues to be at the brink of, economic failure. In many senses, a failed state which doesn't have control over various swaths of its territory, but also, where a lot of its people are feeling the brunt of failed economic policies today. And any further steps in terms of escalation will cost them very heavily. Even the deployment of troops in forward locations is an expensive exercise. To send troops and to maintain them along the border, to keep them in a state of readiness, to provide backup ammunition, logistical support is very expensive. So Pakistan is going through all of those issues. And I think any conflict will impact on them. But let's face it, conflict over a prolonged period is not good for anybody. We ourselves have a growth a vision for high growth, to become a developed country in the next 20, 25 years. We have to ensure that we are on that trajectory, that this sort of, provocation has to be dealt with, but should not be distracting, that it not only serves to slow down your growth, but also to, in some senses, hyphenate you or re-hyphenate you with Pakistan. I think we have come out of that hyphenation. There is a clear de-hyphenation with that country, and we need to keep it that way. And one of the reasons for the attack also is to say, look, we are here and, don't forget us. In a certain sense, it's Pakistan's attempt to again equate itself with us, and that's what their endeavor is even globally today, to talk about two nuclear-powered countries on the brink of war, etc. The same story, which I think doesn't hold water anymore. I have absolutely no reason for us to hold back on those considerations.
Mr. Shingla, Pakistan will be a part of a meeting of the United Nations non-permanent members of the Security Council overnight India time. How do you see this playing out in the United Nations, particularly since India seems to have picked up a great deal of support?
Yes, I think Pakistan is using its current membership in the UN Security Council as a non-permanent member, of course. Using that to, manipulate the proceedings of the Security Council. India has, I think, been very active or proactive in reaching out to all members of the UN Security Council. I think the External Affairs Minister has reached out. We've reached out at various levels. not only to the P5 but also to the elected members. I think it's very clear that you need to ensure that your friends in the council speak up for you, ensure that the objectives that you need to achieve through the council in calling a spade a spade, which is an act of terrorism by Pakistan, sponsored by Pakistan through the LET and its affiliates, has to be called out. And I think it's very important to ensure that the council's outcomes reflect the reality. And we do not allow Pakistan to subvert that process that's in. So our diplomacy in the United Nations and otherwise, I think, is very important at this point of time.
President Putin called up the Prime Minister. They spoke about the situation, and Russia has extended full support to India in the fight against terror. Now, Russia has always been a very close ally of ours. We've seen many statements from the United States, not so many statements from Russia, but this call seems to have changed that. How important is Russia's support in this situation?
I think Russia, as a permanent member of the UN Security Council, as an important pole in a multipolar world, their views are important. And I think the fact that President Putin has strongly condemned terrorism and stated his support for India in this endeavor in his conversation with Prime Minister Modi is an important signal from Russia. But I think, we have got good support from across the world. There are countries, starting from the United States, President Trump was quick off the block, but then you had many senior people from the U.S. making statements in support of India's stand with regard to the recent Pahalgam attack. But even countries like Iran have, I think, condemned terrorism unequivocally. And I think that itself is a sign that across the globe, there is support for our stance that terrorism has to be dealt with in very severely.
In fact, the Iranian foreign minister is going to be here on Thursday. Do you believe a country like Iran can have some sort of stake in trying to bring about a peace between India and Pakistan at this stage? Or do you believe that India needs to stick to our belief, which has always been that is a bilateral issue, we'll sort it out?
No, I think that, a country like India does not need intervention or mediation by any other country, be it the United States or Iran. I think that has been made clear to the Iranians from what I can see in terms of various public releases. The Iranian foreign minister has been keen to de-hyphenate the India-Pakistan angle from his visit. He's visiting Pakistan today, but he's going to fly back to Tehran and then come to India on the 7th. I think, I think our side has made clear to him from what I can see reading between the lines, that his visit has been seen as purely bilateral, one that that goes into issues that are, of bilateral interest, maybe some discussions on regional and global issues, but that there is no scope for any mediation or intervention by any party or partner at this point of time. Iran, of course, is a neighbor of Pakistan. There's no doubt about that. But I don't think we need that level of intervention. We can deal with the situation ourselves, and we have been dealing with this. We know how to deal with Pakistan in a manner that I think will keep them, in the right place.
All right, Ambassador Shringla, wonderful speaking to you. Thank you very much, sir, for being with us.